From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time for All Tech Considered. Today we're going to dig a little bit into a problem that seems to plague all of our increasingly web-based lives. From our emails to those Netflix accounts and credit card statements, I'm talking about the curse of the online password. How do you actually keep track of all those bizarre combinations of letters and numbers we're forced to come up with every day? Just coming up with them in the first place seems to be tough enough. Well, it's time for some solutions. But first, we sent producer Sky Road to ask a few folks about their own password predicaments.
My name is Cherry Brownlee. I have so many passwords, I can't keep track of them. I have a company, and I have to call the person in charge of accounting to keep track of all of our passwords on our various accounts. It's one of the curses of technology.
My name's Grant Crilly, and I had to throw away a $500 laptop because I forgot my password, and no one could figure out how to fix it. Apple tried, and they couldn't get it. And when your company can't fix your computer, there's a big problem.
Hello, my name is Rabina. Stumbling over trying to find the perfect password that I would remember, well, I just thought, who am I? What do I look like? And what's going on in my life? I'm a grandmother. I have dreadlocks. And I'm an artist. So I say that all in a different language.
I'm Carlin from Connecticut, and my password story goes like this. It was one of the first 3 professional development days at school before the kids were there, and we had gotten a new computer system at school, and they were trying to get all the faculty logged in with individual passwords because it was going to be used as our grading system. And they gave us a set of directions, you know, try this, try that, you know, here your password should be unique and only identifiable to you. And I tried everything. I tried my name, I tried my birthday, I tried all the old standbys. It wasn't taking anything. So I became rather frustrated, and in my frustration, hit the caps lock and typed, and it took. And then I spent the next probably 3 minutes trying to figure out how to undo the damage, and I'm thinking in my head, I don't have tenure. This is a public high school. This is bad.
I'm Drew Tewksbury. I'm a freelance writer out here in Los Angeles, and my problem with a password that I had was probably about 4 years ago. I was working at a company and I was trying to get online, and it turned out that my password wasn't working, so I had to call tech support. So I talked to them. I'm like, is there any way that you could fix this? Can you get into my program somehow? And they said, no, we have to use your password. And I'm like, oh my God, my password. It's so embarrassing. I don't want to tell you what it is. And they said, we can't get in there anyway without your password. So just tell us your password. And so I said, all right, I'm going to tell you, but you're not going to be happy about it. My password is ninjas in my pants.
That montage is from independent producer Sky Road. And you may not want to choose ninjas in your pants as your password, although it is memorable. But chances are you still struggle with keeping track of everything from time to time. And here to help us clarify the how-to is our resident tech expert, Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. Welcome, Omar.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
So why do we need so many passwords? Why can't we have something like a universal remote, one password that we can use for everything?
Well, I think you just gave the IT people at NPR a heart attack. Having one username and password for all the sites you access is a very bad idea, because if someone cracks one of those passwords, they have access to all of your accounts. So it's also a bad idea to use a password that's any word that can be found in the dictionary. So the ideal password is usually about 8 letters long, preferably 14 or 15, and includes letters in lower and uppercase, as well as numbers and symbols. I do know that I'm going to have to go back and change all of mine because I didn't know ninjas in my pants was so widely used. But the last thing you want to do is use the same password as your login name to use family information like your date of birth or birth of your kids as passwords, or to write down your password on a Post-it note and stick it on your desk. I know everybody does that, but that's another way to drive your IT department crazy.
Now, there are people who've looked into this, and you've talked to some of them. What have they found?
Well, I spoke to Nick Forcier, the CEO of a company called Large Software. They make a piece of software called Password Manager for Windows. He says that the average user has at least 5 to 7 logins and passwords to keep track of at any one time, and that the solution is to use software like that that can keep track of them all and can also generate much stronger passwords for you. You wouldn't have to come up with them yourself. On the Mac side, I've been using a program called 1Password. and the number one password, which keeps all of my passwords remembered and is easily accessible in the web browser. And one reason I really like it is that there's also an iPhone version of it that transfers all of my passwords to my phone. So if I'm accessing websites on the go, it has the same passwords as my desktop. And there's even a handheld device I've been playing around with called the Logio Secure Password Organizer. It's a little white device the size of a credit card, and you actually type in your website's logins and passwords into it. It's encrypted, and you only have to remember one master numerical passcode. And if you can remember that, you've got all your passwords in front of you, and if it gets stolen, it's protected by that.
Now, there's some basic do's and don'ts when it comes to passwords. Perhaps we can just tick through some of this quickly. How often should you change your password?
Some people say every 6 months. Others, like Nick Forcier that I talked to, said as often as once a month. I'd say it depends on how sensitive your online accounts are and how good you are at keeping track of them and remembering them. If you lose them or can't remember them, changing them once a month isn't going to do any good.
Now, is it a good or a bad idea to click that Remember My Password tab that we see so often when we log on?
Well, it really depends on whether you're sharing a computer with others in a public or workspace, or if you're the primary user. If it's a home computer that only you are using, it's fine. But if other people can access the same machine, or if you're on an unsecured wireless network, you definitely want to deselect that option.
Before we leave the subject of passwords, I have one last question. Sometimes passwords are assigned to you by a website or a retailer. Should you accept that or just immediately change that first opportunity you get?
You should change it and get it consistent with whatever system you're using to remember them. For one thing, you could lose the password and then you don't have access to it anymore. And also, you know, it's much more difficult to remember a random password assigned to you than something where you've got a consistent system or a place to store it.
Now, I understand that you're going to be posting a lot of these links on our website on the blog.
Yes, definitely. We're going to be posting links to a lot of this software and a lot of tips. But we also wanted to make note of some of the posts we received from last week's segment. We talked about what happens to your passwords and private information when you die. And we actually received some really great posts on the blog and on the story segment from people who have had that experience, who have had family members who have passed away, and they've set up online memorials on Facebook or have had to control the website after a family member died. Some really moving stories that we got on the website.
Well, we'd love to hear from you, meaning our listeners, about your password strategies. If you use ninjas in your pants or it's Christmas in July, whatever it is, we'd love to hear about it. This is a joint learning process, so you can write to us at the All Tech page at www.npr.org/alltech. No password required. Omar, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
That's Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. This is NPR, National Public Radio. If you're in the market for investments that can make you money and make a difference, a new online broker thinks it's got just what you're looking for. Microplace.com wants to make it easier for people to invest in microfinance. Microfinance means small loans, a loan, for example, to a woman in the third world to start a business. Dan Bobkoff of member station WCPN in Cleveland explains this investment concept.
After reading a book by microfinance pioneer Muhammad Yunus, Paul Metzloff was inspired by the ability of small loans to help raise people out of poverty. The fourth-year seminary student from Columbus wanted to find a way to put some of his money into microloans.
If I can use my little bits of money to help people who are truly poor, then I think that's a good thing, even if I'm not making massive interest on it.
So Metzloff started investing at microplace.com. The site, which is a for-profit arm of eBay, acts as an online broker for microfinance securities. They're similar to bonds, and most pay a return between 1 and 3%. But with the financial crisis driving down rates on traditional savings accounts and money market funds, MicroPlace hopes more Americans will look to its site as an investment alternative.
We've launched recently a 5 and 6% rate of return, which is very, very interesting to people in the current economy.
Ashwini Narayanan is MicroPlace's general manager, and she's making the pitch that investing in these microfinance securities is a fairly safe alternative to traditional investments. They are not FDIC-insured rock-solid savings accounts, but so far, she says, no one has lost any money. Microfinance has been largely immune to the global recession, and Narayanan says about 97% of borrowers, even the poorest, pay back their loans.
The whole microfinance industry works on the basis of trust. The loan officer knows the borrower, has to make sure that the borrower can actually make that interest payment.
Still, there are real risks here. The securities on MicroPlace are made up of bundled microloans. That's supposed to diversify the investments, lowering risk. But that's eerily similar to mortgage-backed securities, says Case Western Reserve University finance professor Scott Shane.
The problem that we saw with the mortgage-backed securities is, what if there's an effect that hurts absolutely everybody in that economy? You know, you have an earthquake somewhere, or you have a financial crisis in that home country.
Perhaps it's that fear that's keeping people from putting more of their money into these microfinance securities. While the company says its users are investing far more money this year than last, there are fewer than 5,000 investors so far on the site. By comparison, Kiva, a nonprofit competitor that's been around a few years longer, has nearly 500,000 users, even though they earn no interest. MicroPlace's average account size is about $350. Paul Metzloff, the investor from Columbus, has invested over $2,000 so far. And while the interest rates are an incentive to put more money in, he says it's the moral attraction that keeps him hooked.
You can choose to help some poor woman in Guatemala run a grocery store to feed her children. And, you know, I'm not very knowledgeable about financial things, but I would rather do that than help some wealthy businessman fly on a private jet to get a facial at a spa.
MicroPlace is finding that despite the rising interest rates, most of its users are like Metzloff. They see it more as charity than an investment tool. So the company is reevaluating its sales pitch, trying to present itself not as the next great investment, but as the face of modern philanthropy. For NPR News, I'm Dan Bobkoff in Cleveland.
French lawmakers passed a controversial new law yesterday, some say under pressure from the international music industry. The law would punish people who illegally share copyrighted music or movies without permission by taking away their right to use the internet for up to a year. NPR's Netta Ulibi reports.
It's a three-strikes-you're-out law that would kick people off French internet if they're accused, say, of illegally downloading a song by the president's wife, pop singer Carla Bruni. The rule horrifies digital civil rights advocates like Danny O'Brien. He coordinates international outreach for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. What troubles him most, he says, is that the bill completely does away with due process.
There's no judge keeping an eye on this, there's no right of appeal, and it's entirely separate from the usual judicial system.
Proof is not necessary. A record company has to simply say, j'accuse, and an organization still to be created by the French government will sever your internet connection. This law might not even be legal in France. It's up to the country's version of the Supreme Court to approve, and it ultimately may be trumped by the European Union.
It's certainly one of the more extreme attempts to control internet behavior that I've seen.
The French government was reportedly under pressure by the lobbying arm of the international music industry. Despite its best efforts, file sharing worldwide has only increased. O'Brien says innocent people have been prosecuted, and the system can be gamed. It's especially easy to make mistakes any place the internet is public, like cybercafes.
The French government has come up with some interesting suggestions for this. One was that anybody who has an open Wi-Fi network should just shut it down or only allow a certain whitelist of websites for people to visit.
O'Brien says he's surprised that the home of liberty, France, is the first country to implement laws he describes as draconian. He's not alone. 60% of French citizens oppose the rule. Predictably, they've begun manning the cyber barricades. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.